Welcome to the fourth podcast of the ninth edition of the Essential Knowledge Update program from the Royal College of General Practitioners.
My name is Dr. Doug Pilat, and I'm the clinical lead for the project. It's now the end of August, and summer seems to be over before it has started. Here at EKU Central, the tea and coffee making facilities have already been packed and stowed away, as the move to our new headquarters is looming in a few weeks. By the way, if you haven't donated yet, there's still time, and I'm sure the honorary treasurer would be delighted about even the smallest and biggest of contributions. EKU 10, which is still very much a child of our transitional headquarters, is already being readied for the next release, and as this is my last podcast as the clinical lead for the Essential Knowledge Update program, I thought to introduce you to the methods that lie behind this immensely popular continuous professional development tool. As you probably have read, the most important aspects of EKU are that the content that we feature is not older than 6 months at the time production starts, that it's written by GPs for GPs, and that it is actually applicable for the frontline GP. To achieve this, our information scientists produce a large Excel file containing about 300 guidelines, reviews, and articles that I then whittle down to about 40, with an emphasis on use for everyday general practice. I then suggest these 40 sources to a 10-strong editorial board made up of very eminent general practitioners who individually vote for those items they find particularly suitable and which ones they want to see as majors and which ones as minors. The results of the vote will then be forwarded to me and the actual work of authoring begins. EKU has an excellent set of talented and experienced authors, all of them GPs, who will then attempt to create a short and readable update out of a 300-page NICE guideline or an unwieldy paper. Not an easy task. After the authors have finalized their work, and I am happy with the outcome, all modules go then through a 3-stage quality assurance procedure, in which the content will again and again be submitted to another set of GPs, who will fact-check, assess the quality of the writing, and the applicability for its audience. That would be you. Then all is uploaded to the web and packed nicely for the big release day, and a few days later, the next Excel file with 300 new sources lands in my inbox. This is about the time that I find out about the typos that I've missed. Now that you know how it all works, let's hear Dr. Thomas Round's thoughts on the stable angina module that featured in EKU 9. Based on the latest NICE guidelines and hugely important for our day-to-day practice, I asked Tom about the epidemiology of stable angina in the UK.
Okay, so we're talking today about stable angina.
Yes.
Which is the most common form of angina, and that's one that's not deteriorating and the symptoms are fairly stable. I'm sure we're all okay with the symptoms of angina, we'd expect. And in terms of how common it is, about 2 million people in the UK have angina. And the percentages is prevalence is higher in men, and also the prevalence rates go up with age. So between 55 and 64, 8% of men have angina and 3% of women. And between 65 and 74, that goes up to 14% of men and 8% of women. So it's very common, and us as GPs would be expected to see it regularly, I think.
So once the patient has an established diagnosis of stable angina, is the risk of myocardial infarction elevated?
Yes, yeah, so there is an association, but the guidelines say that's a low risk. A low but appreciable risk. So you kind of want to manage secondary risk factors. So everyone with angina should really be on a statin. You need to think about aspirin, the pros and cons and their bleeding history, and also obviously blood pressure control. If they've got diabetes, consider an ACE inhibitor, all these type of things to kind of prevent progression to ultimately a myocardial event.
Mm-hmm. So let's hypothesize that we have a patient, a male patient in his 50s who actually has been to A&E and has been seen by the cardiologist and has been diagnosed with stable angina and comes back to your surgery and say, "Doctor, I've got angina. What should I do now? And what shouldn't I do?"
Yeah, I think via the A&E route may be less likely, or they'd maybe refer to chest pain clinic. So probably they'd go via a rapid access chest pain service. So if it's a new, if it's us seeing them and we think chest pain query angina, we'd probably refer to rapid access chest pain if not been clinic, if they've not been seen there before. They'd probably work them up and work out if they've got stable angina, and then they come back to see us. They may or may not have started on medication. We certainly should give them information and support about their diagnosis, because it's a chronic disease and it may wax and wane. And the whole point of medication, which we'll come on to later, is to control the symptoms and enable people to have a good quality of life without the angina affecting them. In terms of information and support you'd want to give, obviously you want to say it's a long-term condition. You'd want to tell them about factors that can provoke angina, such as exertion, stress, or temperature extremes, or heavy meals. You'd maybe want to discuss with them what they understand by angina, because they might feel that it means they've had a heart attack or something, and it doesn't necessarily mean that. Of course, it means a slightly higher risk, but you need to talk about that, about risk factor modification, really, and also generally about self-management and activity pacing and looking to see what they can and can't do. Could discuss, as I say, weight, diet, exercise, smoking, all the kind of general lifestyle factors that we'd look at for these patients.
Now, I get plenty of concerned gentlemen after a diagnosis of angina asking whether it's okay to still have sex. What does the guideline say there?
As far as I'm aware, it's fine to continue sex. Obviously, if they get angina symptoms during sex, you need to discuss it and have a look at their medication, see if they're optimally managed. But absolutely, they can still have sex with angina.
Is there any age limit to the treatment of stable angina, or do my older patients benefit just as well?
The evidence is they benefit just as well. So the guidelines are quite clear that you shouldn't exclude people from treatment based on their age or ethnicity or different sex. So everyone, basically, the guidelines are very simple, because you treat everyone the same.
Okay. And is there anything out there that I should not suggest?
Yeah, so NICE reviewed the evidence, found there's no evidence for recommending any vitamins or fish oils. So if any patients think they might have read something on that, there's no good quality evidence to recommend those. Also no evidence for TENS, that's transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, which you may have seen for chronic pain or back pains, no evidence for that, and no evidence for acupuncture.
Okay, so if I have somebody who's been diagnosed with stable angina, what would be the first line medication I should put them on?
So first line medication would be medication we're all very comfortable with, which would be beta blockers or a calcium channel blocker as first line. And you'd basically initiate that, and the first line treatment would be either one of those medications or possibly a combination of both. Obviously you'd want to start it and maybe review the patient after 2 to 4 weeks. For example, if you're starting beta blockers, you may want to titrate those up gently. Calcium channel blockers is less of a titration. The calcium channel blockers you'd use would be amlodipine, which a lot of us would use for blood pressure control, or phenylephrine, or slow-release nifedipine.
Okay. And you said that if I don't get adequate symptom control, with one or the other, I can combine them?
Yes, you can combine the two, yes. So that's what NICE recommends as a kind of first line. So you first line, think about beta blocker or calcium channel blocker. Obviously, look at what the patient's had before. They may have blood pressure problems already. I mean, hypertension is obviously very common in this age group. So have a look at what they're on already, and think about a combination of the two. Maybe titrate up the beta blocker and then review them to see what their symptom control's like as first line.
Mm-hmm. So the good old days where you would start off with the nitrates are obviously over.
So you wouldn't, that you're talking about long acting nitrate.
Yes.
Obviously, you would still prescribe a short acting nitrate, GTN spray, for acute episodes. And the general advice for that would be take 2 sprays, repeat again after 5 minutes. If 5 minutes after the second dose short acting GTN, they still have chest pain, then they should seek medical advice or call an ambulance. Mm-hmm. But obviously, the long acting ones are not first line. No.
Okay. But is there still a role for nitrates in angina?
Yeah. So if you're going on to now second line, so now we've got the patient. They've maybe on a beta block. Maybe they didn't tolerate a beta blocker. They're on a calcium channel blocker. They're still having angina symptoms. Maybe walking up a couple of flights of stairs or doing some mild exertion or moderate exertion, and it's affecting them. Then you would want to start on second line treatment, which would be your long acting nitrate. And as I said, that includes people who can't tolerate either the calcium channel blocker or the beta blocker and they're still having symptoms, you move on to the second line. So generally, most of us would probably use a long-acting nitrate there. There's a couple of other medications there, which we probably heard of Nicorandil, mm-hmm. which is a vasodilator. And then NICE also has a couple of medications which I've not used before, but that's in the second line treatment. That includes ivabradine,
yes,
and ranolazine.
Okay, I presume we would probably have a little chat with cardiological colleagues so. Before we start that.
So I'm comfortable to start long acting nitrates, so that they're second line medications.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other medication they should be on?
Well, like we said, so I probably discuss the pros and cons of aspirin, look at their past history of GI bleeding, etc. If there's no history of that and they haven't got dyspepsia, uncontrolled dyspepsia, maybe start them on aspirin. I'd start them on a cholesterol tablet, check their blood pressure. You'd be aiming for cholesterol at least less than 5, ideally maybe less than 4.5, and obviously following blood pressure control according to QOF. And then in terms of looking at other medication, what NICE is saying here, do not offer any kind of third angina agent if they're controlled on two drugs. Mm-hmm. And consider a third medication only when the person's symptom not controlled on two drugs.
Okay.
And it's a question about whether they require revascularization or not.
So there we have it. Thank you for choosing EKU as a means of keeping up to date. And thank you all for leaving loads of encouraging and productive feedback on the site. Also, a big thank you for amazing colleagues at EKU headquarters for making my role as enjoyable as it has been. This was the fourth podcast of EKU 9, and it was produced with the help of Audacity, the free and open sound editor. The title music was by Matt Bianco, who was so kind to let us use the track. My name is Dr. Doc Pilat. Goodbye.